Welcome to Paradigm Shifters. We're going to have some fun with today's Paradigm Shifter, Robin Gregory, who's been an amazing artist, kind of pulling a character named Muji Littleman out of her imagination and gosh knows what other sources, and we're going to find out today. It's such a wonderful story that you've self-published, and it's so rich in what would you call it, in kind of mystical and fairy tale kind of imagery. It's just such an exciting story. I couldn't put it down. So, Robin, welcome to the show.
Thank you. And hello, Veronica. It's really great to be here. This is my first radio show.
Oh, really? Oh, I'm so delighted to do it because we've connected before, but not over this. So here we are. Muji Littleman. Why don't you tell people where you came up with that title? I want to say something first of all about you, that you're a journalist or have been. You're also in the spiritual realm as a minister and an infant massage instructor for mothers and babies at risk. And I love that Muji is a disabled young boy. And I thought that must be why it's so alive, what he has to do in order to move his body through life. You know what I mean? You have a knowing. You have a very, what do we call it, a healer's knowing, don't you?
Well, I get a lot of help, I'll tell you that, from the celestial sources. And I guess, would you like me to tell you a little bit about myself and
writing? Okay. I would love that, yeah. And our listeners like that, too. They like to be able to relate to the amazing geniuses we talk to.
Well, I would never have thought of myself that way, ever. I was the third of seven siblings, and people often ask me if it wasn't a lot of fun, you know, having all those siblings, five sisters and two brothers, always somebody to play with and somebody to sing and run and laugh with. And I say, yes, it was a lot of fun. Have you ever read Lord of the Flies? And I laugh because it was crazy. My mother was a high school beauty queen, tall and long-limbed and Catholic and mostly Irish. And my father, a Navy pilot, a riflesmith, and a cowboy. And you often hear stories about how writers knew early on that they wanted to write, like they were conjugating verbs before cutting their first teeth.
And, conjugating their teeth, you might say.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't one of those. And instead of reading and writing little stories like Toni Morrison and Ursula Le Guin, I was burping babies and changing diapers and looking for bathrooms.
Oh.
You know, in a car with eight sticky, squirming kids, you can't go very far without a bathroom. So while others were spinning yarns, I was running the little ones from the car to the church restroom or the service station or the bush or, like I said, burping or changing diapers. And so, but I still had this wild imagination, and I really wanted to be the good witch in The Wizard of Oz.
Oh.
I wanted to save the underdog very early on, but I was mischievous and headstrong and often mistaken for a boy. Pixie haircut and cowboy boots. And, you know, I was like Zorro at First Communion or the Cisco Kid at the Easter egg hunt. Always a daydreamer, always in trouble. I wanted to build forts, and I wanted to shoot a .38 and ride into the sunset and smoke Marlboro cigarettes when I was in elementary school.
Now, did you smoke Marlboro cigarettes in grade school?
I did.
Uh-oh.
I shouldn't say that because I think my mom's going to listen to this and she's going to be shocked. She has a whole different idea of who I was. But at the time, it wasn't weird. You know, people weren't talking about health issues or problems with cigarettes. It was just a grown-up thing to do.
Right. I remember the days, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You never did that, though, did you?
Oh, of course. actually, no, to tell you the truth, I was disgusted by cigarette smoking. And my whole family, everybody smoked, and I used to hate it. But then I started smoking because I was dieting later, so I used it instead of food. So that was a crap, you know. But anyway, back to you.
Back to cigarette, back to truth, okay. Well, what my siblings and I used to form crews, and we used to march the grasses looking for broken critters to rescue.
Oh, wow.
You know, like swallows stricken from their nests. One of our neighbors did that every year, or lizards or stray kittens or whatever. But, you know, so I never really read much. Story time with eight of us was impossible, except for the times we visited our granny in small numbers. There was no such thing. But Granny used to serve us herbal tea and homemade cookies before bedtime and then read something like Maurice Sendak to us. And Granny's house smelled like seawater and ivory soap. And when I think of Maurice Sendak's books, I still smell sea and soap. It's just a wonderful, wonderful memory.
Aww.
So nothing was like anybody else that comes about in writing. As for reading, I had trouble as a child. So I really like to make little booklets, though, and to draw animals, and I still have some of them. My mother used to turn red when I showed them to her because I'd gone to great pains erasing and redrawing, and making sure they were anatomically correct.
Wow.
Gender correct. So, and then also at the time, as you probably remember, there was only one TV station in California, in our area, California, and that was Channel 8.
Mm-hmm.
We had Mickey Mouse, Ed Sullivan, and the Lawrence Welk show to choose from. So we didn't watch a lot of TV. We amused ourselves by staging plays, which was kind of my segue into storytelling. We would fit ourselves with costumes and use music from records. And like every Christmas, we did the nativity story, putting the latest baby in a cardboard manger. And we girls fought like raccoons over who got to play the Mother Mary. And so one year our granny gave us grass skirts, and there I was, a freckled cowboy, doing the hula to Alfred Apaka records, telling stories with my hands. And so those are my earliest storytelling experiences. But later, eventually, reading and language got easier and spelling got easier. I know English is just a bear of a language to learn.
Were you dyslexic or that sort of thing?
I don't know what they would call it at the time. Because whatever it was corrected when I got to like junior year in high school.
Hmm.
And I discovered writing like Kafka and Hemingway and just absolutely fell in love with reading, and then started doing the keeping journals and collecting books and writing stories. And that's when I started giving my soul a voice.
Mm.
It was always a good way to troll for buried truth, to view things new in a new way, or to be present as the watcher of my own self. I mean, I love the way David White, the poet, says it's a writing for him is a matter of eavesdropping on yourself. And that's really sort of how it feels for me, too.
I love that. That's great. So let's go back to you, and you're talking about writing as a way to kind of observe yourself and to really attune to yourself, aren't you?
Yeah, to a self that I haven't really understood or known until I started searching for more a divine sense of myself. And, you know, I've been searching for truth for 40 years, and 15 of those years working with other souls to bring about harmony and healing. And it was my son that really launched me into a whole new universe of understanding. And it's funny how that happens, how so often heartbreaking is what has to happen before we're ready to look at things like that.
And what happened with your son? Are you willing to share that story with us?
Well, I can tell you this much. My husband and I adopted a disabled baby. And you know, I thought for so long that all he would need was the human love and guidance and whatnot to help him on his way to find independence. And boy, was I wrong. I mean, it was a huge job, and I don't think anybody's ever really prepared for something like that. We just sort of stumble along and learn as we go. And everything that our son did was different. The way he talked, the way he walked, the way he learned, everything was different. So I was constantly seeking ways to help him, fit in somehow, and to help him find a purpose, and to help him.
And was he a newborn? Was it a newborn child?
Yeah.
And I guess you wouldn't know at the beginning whether it was brain damage or I guess you wouldn't know what the source of it was, right?
Yeah, it wasn't diagnosed till later, and they call it cerebral palsy, although I don't believe in labels. I never did, and I never really accepted that for my son. And neither my husband or I look at him as in that way. We feel that it is our job to find what is inherently true and right about him in spite of appearances, and to help him learn to express that.
It's very interesting, Robin, because you were talking about how going into literature or understanding writing or poetry or whatever, and writing yourself helped you to observe yourself. So having this child, you're trying to teach, it's sort of parallel to me. I'm going, isn't that kind of an interesting parallel where him observing himself and finding his own uniqueness and so on, eh?
Definitely. I don't want to call it a process. The experience was parallel. Both of us were working at the same thing. I shouldn't say working, making an effort to be free of what is not true. And I, in order to be his mom, I had to learn to get off of some of my limiting beliefs. For example, for as long as I remember, as I can remember, I've been a seeker, and I felt sort of out of place in this world and wanting to understand my purpose for being here.
Right.
But I didn't know how to go about doing that, and life has been such a struggle early on, and it was mostly because I didn't know what I had to offer. I didn't know my purpose for being with other people and relationship and whatnot. So I suffered a lot, and I tried to look to others to give me purpose, sidestepping the issue, until my husband and I adopted this child. And what happened was, one day after years of struggling with, you know, therapies and tutors and doctors and surgery and special ed equipment, agencies, medical insurance stuff, it was all new to me.
Wow. What a labyrinth, eh?
Oh, it was just very, very difficult. Mostly also, though, because I felt like I was totally responsible, and I didn't have a really strong spiritual practice yet. But one day our son took a bad fall and split his head open.
Oof.
And I remember feeling so angry at life at that moment, you know, just so discouraged and so forsaken. You know, seeing how futile all of my efforts were to help him be safe, to keep safe, and how I couldn't help him humanly. I couldn't help him very much. I was just at the end of my rope. And I remember surrendering completely at that moment and just reaching to Spirit for help. And after that, I really couldn't sidestep anymore. If I was going to help him, I had to find a way beyond my own limited thinking about who I was. So that's what started the journey through, like you, through Christian Science, Buddhism, science of mind, and infinite way. That's what started the journey.
Thank heaven. And so what happened with your son? Did he... I think what's interesting... Okay, I'm just going to segue. Another concept, Robin, is sometimes how we look at people can either blunt their possibility. You know, I'm often astounded at this, even just how we look at them. Oh, poor little boy, can keep him smaller and less able. I just wondered, so talk about him. What happened with him? Did he change as you surrendered? What happened?
Well, you know, He's despite appearances, he's a brilliant and gifted child. And some of the things that happen in the book, in Muji's story, actually really did happen.
I thought so. That's because in the book, it's so alive, Robin.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So cute.
And I wanted to make it feel real. You know, I didn't want to go into fantasy, spacey, airy fairy. I wanted to ground it in reality, you know, so that people could maybe consider that miracles are actually real and they're accessible. Mm-hmm. And it's not something that's really only a few people can have this. And so gradually, Julian is a very strong-willed child, like I was. And he's amazing. He really responds to spiritual truths, and he did early on. For example, when he first manifested a cold, and I said to him, this is such a good one in Christian Science, is, no, that occult term doesn't have any power over you. You can make a decision here. You can make a decision. And you can say, well, no, thank you. I don't really need to do this. Or you can say, okay, well, here I go again, which so many people do. And he caught on right away. And, of course, the cold symptoms disappeared within the day. And I think in his life, he's 24 now. He may have had one cold.
Wow.
And that was just from a weak moment. It was a weak moment when he didn't call on that part of himself and say, oh, wait a minute, I don't have to do this. He was feeling a little vulnerable at this time. So we've taught him that he has so many choices. And for example, going through school, we always try to normalize his life. We never talk about his quote-unquote problems with other people, and especially never in front of him. Hmm. We always treat him as always an equal. And he's rising to the task. It's been a long journey, but he's rising slowly to the task.
Did he make it through the normal school system, or did you put him in special schools?
That's a good question. We always had him in a normal school setting that had support, special ed support for him. And we were fearful of that at first because we thought he might be singled out. But Veronica, it has been so beautiful the way children, and I'm talking about children of privilege that have never seen a child on a walker, have embraced him. And he was even invited to be on the football team in high school. He was given a uniform. He went to all the games and helped out in whatever way he could. It's just been a miraculous. So many things have opened up because we expect them to happen. We expect him to have a rich, full life. And so often we've encountered families that are so fearful with children with special needs. Mm-hmm. They want to hide them. They want to keep them safe and sheltered, and I don't think it does them much of a favor.
Mm-mm. But it is important to have people around who, if you know, because sometimes kids are cruel. You knew that as a child. And
yeah.
It's nice to have conscious supporters around as well, isn't it?
Well, it is, but we've taught him, you know, one of the most difficult things for him has always been people walking up and saying, what's wrong with you? What happened to you? And he turns red and he just goes, he doesn't think of himself as something being wrong with him.
Mm.
And he's like, it's like walking up to somebody who has pimples and saying, what happened to your face? It throws him way off. And what he's learned to do is either say something like, well, I'm fine, thank you. I got to get going. Or he just turns and says, I got to go, and walks away. He doesn't respond to it. He doesn't register to it. If I'm with him, I'll say something kind to like a child. I'll say something like, he'll be okay, honey. He just uses a walker to get around now, just for now. And they just need reassurance. But it always shocks me when adults walk up to him and say that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of surprised.
The thing that I remembered, I worked with disabled many years ago, and they used to say, and they were all in wheelchairs and so on, and they used to say, they called us ABs, able bodies. And they say you have to learn early on to get the ABs comfortable because they don't know how to talk to you or be with you. And so they taught a lot of things on how to speak to ABs so that they could be made at ease, you know. They could feel your power as opposed to your disability only, you know. So it's big. That's a big subject because people just don't know what to do, right?
Yeah, and, you know, a funny example of that, I had to make a few adjustments in the book because in one of the earlier versions, I had Moody writing something ungrammatically. He has a lot of trouble with reading and writing. Mm-hmm. And the editor thought it made him look stupid. So I realized, well, you know, a lot of people are going to just jump to that conclusion because somebody can't read and write, they're stupid. So I had to make it simple. And I love this quote by Madeline Long. She wrote young adult stories.
Oh,
she
right.
Said, if the book, do you remember that name?
A Wrinkle in Time. And I can't remember. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If the book will be too difficult for grown-ups, then you write it for children. And so I thought, oh, that is so awesome. So, like I said, I took that part out because I didn't want people to jump to that conclusion. But I certainly didn't want to delve into what seemed wrong with Moody. I wanted to bring out what was intrinsically right. And that is how we help one another. And
well, I think you were very, very wonderful. This story, I'm telling the listeners that this is a wonderful, wonderful story. And the thing that I loved is that you could really feel the inner process of Moody. You know, like all of us, we're kind of locked inside at a certain level, aren't we? Trying to find what that power is. And he really did a lot of that contemplative kind of work in this story. I loved it. I loved him.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you like that. I know a lot of readers are impatient with that kind of stuff, so I had to temper it. I myself like reading books like that, too. I like to have motivations made clear, and the explorations of the characters are my exploration of them writing it. I don't often have the answers. In fact, I wasted many years trying to figure out what my book was going to be about.
Hmm.
They weren't wasted, but I mean, I didn't realize really what I wanted to do for years.
But it's interesting because you started talking about your own childhood and being one of eight children, and you said something about the Lord of the Flies. And it's occurring to me in this part of our conversation that in the Lord of the Flies, we didn't really get that much. I don't remember, actually. I might have to reread it. But the inner process of some of these boys who went wild against one another on a desert island or whatever it was, we didn't get that much of their inner process, did we?
No, and you're right. You're so right. It wasn't made clear. And at the time, that was okay. You know, people weren't asking as much of stories, I don't think. It was more of a horrific adventure.
Mm-hmm.
And now, I think nowadays, had that writer been writing that story now, I think there would be a lot more, or at least a little more, inner functioning going on and inner explanations. And I'm not sure.
But I think what did you say? You said sometimes people get bored or get impatient with that. But I think a lot of us who are on the spiritual journey, or whatever we want to call it, the metaphysical journey, the inner empowerment journey. There's all these different reflections of what I'm trying to say. Most of us try to figure out or pick out the inner motivation of characters that we don't understand or that are different, right? I think most of us
that. Yeah, I think you're right. And also for that very reason, I think a lot of people on the spiritual path aren't real interested in fiction normally.
That's right.
Because it doesn't very often go in those places. That I'm very choosy with the books that I read in fiction because a lot of it is, I feel, not useful to me. And a lot of writers want me to do swaps and reviews and stuff, and I can't do it because I have to read stuff that doesn't mean anything to me, and I'm supposed to make good comments on it, and it's just not a fair swap. I'd normally want to read nonfiction.
Well, I think that with Muji Littleman, you know, and I'm an old literature buff, and even though I'm an intuitive now, and so on, and I love poetry, but there's been a lot of inner cogitative material in there, a lot of inner introspective material in his life, and I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Oh my goodness! Thank you.
Yeah, well, I think it's really important for us to. I guess I kind of see these different echelons of writing, and I just don't bother with the stuff that isn't enriching for my own inner, right? It just helped me understand what the cripple or disabled. I think the word cripple was actually used in there, wasn't it?
But it was, because at that time that's how they would refer to him.
Yes.
In the 1900s, yeah. We didn't have politically correct language at the time.
No, and the effect of death, the grief, the effect of death on his path and how he took it, all of that is very deeply impacting for a lot of us, I believe, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Has he read it? Has your son read the book?
He still can't read real well, but I've offered to read it to him. He said, no thanks. He said, I'm the guy in there. Just tell everybody I'm the guy in there.
Is he funny? He's quite funny, is he?
Oh, he's very funny. So is his father. His father says, tell everybody I'm not the father in there. And it's true, he isn't. I mean, and when we create stories, we have to create conflict. And while his father, Julian's father, is a land surveyor, and I also do land surveying sometimes too, but Muji's father is a land surveyor because he's an interesting character. That's a part of his real father's character that I knew something about, and I thought that would be fun to use that in his character. But a lot of the stuff about the character is not like his father. Our son's father is very gentle and very accepting. Julian, our son, really lucked out in getting him as a dad.
Aww.
But the father in the story, Moody's story, is a little bit lost. You know, he doesn't know what he's capable of, just like so many of us don't.
Well, I thought it was a really wonderful portrayal of a man. The father, to me, and this is for you people at home, when you read this book, let me know what you think about this. But he had an innate sensitivity right off the bat, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And then he
mm-hmm.
behaved what we would consider badly. And but there's something that he gave to Muji, or Muji picked up from him, or something. That's what I liked a lot. I went, gives you faith in the gold mining that we can do with one another in a way, right?
Oh, thank you so much for picking up on that. I'm so glad to hear that, because I didn't want to make him out to be a bad guy. I wanted to make him out to somebody he just wasn't conscious yet.
Yeah.
He wasn't conscious yet.
And we do stupid things. A lot of us do really, we would call it bad things that come from either ignorance or fear or running or whatever, right?
Yes. And as you notice in the story, there was a lot of that in the background with the villagers and their fear of the clan. Thinking that they were Native Americans, that, well, we got rid of all those guys. What are those people doing up there, whatever they are? And
oh, yeah.
Turns out they weren't Native. They weren't
Tell
Native
people
Americans.
About them, because they're a very interesting lot.
Oh, thank you. Well, the Light Eaters, they're a clan that they're hiding in the hills on the St. Isidore's Fainting Goat Dairy Ranch, way up in the hills. And it's funny, because I was researching early civilizations when I was writing this book, because I wanted to find clues to the spiritual lives of the first beings on Earth, thinking that they would be probably so much closer to the divine impulse. They hadn't been so civilized out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I came across a book called The Genius of the Few. Have you heard of that, Veronica?
You what is it called? The Genius of the what?
Of the Few,
okay.
F-E-W.
Okay.
And it's by Christian and Barbara Joy O'Brien.
Okay.
And so it's a very expensive book, but I got it through the library system. It's like a collector's item. I think it's $125 or something. So I got it through the library system, though.
Okay.
And it was fascinating. I ended up reading it, and then I contacted Edmund Marriage, who's the director of the Golden Age Project, who published it, to learn more. And here's what the book is about. There's a series of tablets that were discovered in Iran called the Karzak Epic. I don't know if you've heard of that.
I have heard something. That wasn't that long ago, was it?
No, I think it was maybe in the 70s.
Yeah, okay.
Or the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that the fellow that found them was actually working for British Petroleum. And he was drilling around and looking for oil, I guess, and he came across this cave or something. And anyway, he took hold of these tablets, and he was not going to let anybody take them, like a church or anybody take them. And if they translated them, they would put what it was the oldest creation story that was ever known. And it dated back to 3500 B.C., and it gave the chronology of life in the Jordan Rift Valley 40,000 years ago, which is considered the Garden of Eden. That area is considered the Garden of Eden. So what interested me, and you've probably heard of the heavenly beings called the Anunnaki?
Yes, I have. Yes, I have.
Okay, that's where it was introduced to me. I don't know if they've shown up any other texts. But they gave the story of these Anunnaki as the first heavenly beings to Earth and to come to Earth, and then the creation.
We think of them as the ETs, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so later there came waves of Anunnaki to help civilize humans because they could see they needed help. They were violent and brutal. And as I read more about them, I thought, this is it. This is the celestial culture. And I want this to be the basis for the Light Eaters.
Oh, wonderful.
Story.
Oh.
Yeah.
And that's why they range from being scary and kind of like, not trolls, but, you know, some kind of lower being. And they keep waving this magical aspect, right?
Yeah. And I wanted actually for there to be some doubt as to whether they were human or not, because I feel like they represent, in many ways, the true essence of spiritual being that we've lost as humans, civilized ourselves out of, that actually we share more in common with these celestial beings than we know. And so in some cases, there were several members of the Light Eaters, actually two, that had become so humanized over time that they sort of fell from their heavenly state. One of them ran off and wanted to rejoin humanity, and at the cost of going through the mortal experience again of having to die again.
And that was in the scrolls that were found.
Well, that was one of the members of the clan that was in the story.
Oh, okay.
And the scrolls that the Light Eaters left behind were directions for humans to guide humans on how to respond to the disaster that was coming up.
Mm.
There was a disaster coming up, and they knew it was coming up. The Light Eaters understood the stars. They said that something's going to be repeated that happened many years ago. There's going to be a huge calamity, which turns out at the time it was the San Francisco earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
I had it lined up with that happening at that time.
Well, it was really nicely done. And Muji himself has absorbed the information enough to know what to do with it, right?
Yes. Well, what they did, he wanted to join them. He wanted to make them his family. And they said to him, well, you know, you would have to prove that you could live by the code right off the bat. And I'll let people discover the code for themselves in the story. But if he was willing to live by the code, they would consider it. And they actually, I think, saw in him, at least Ninti, the priestess, one of the elders, saw in him the ability to be a way shower early on. And she sort of helped cultivate that and eventually would turn the scroll over to him.
Well, here's the thing. As I saw Muji, who had been adopted, as one who was very much a part of that clan, and I thought he would just be discovering that as life went on, you know?
Yes, and you're right. He was. It comes out later in the story. His biological father abandoned him, and his mother died in childbirth. So his mother actually had been a member, a clan member.
Isn't that exciting, though? I mean, because to me, that is magical, mysterious, and so possible.
Yeah. Why not?
Well, there's a part of me that really believes in that. Don't you ever? I mean, you said you didn't necessarily want to be here. I didn't want to be here. And a lot of us have felt like, hey, wait a minute, these aren't my people. You know?
Yes.
So,
yes.
And I loved him for that.
Yes, and I don't get that you actually judge people and think that they're less than or there's something wrong with them. It's just, it doesn't feel right somehow. And I sometimes wonder if people like you and maybe myself weren't seated in this earth just the way the Anunnaki were, to come and to help raise the consciousness of people that are still living in the darkness, just like Muji was.
Well, actually, yeah. I have had a number of interviews with people who claim Peter Calhoun, who left our dimensions, he passed over, but he was saying that in his experiences and his visions, there were about 500 million of us seeded onto the planet at this time in order to push it up. So I thought that might lift you to think about that periodically.
Wow. Maybe so.
Yeah.
Like you said, why not?
I know. I mean, it's just stupid to waste all that intelligence that's way out there in the dimensions, isn't it?
Yeah. And I don't know about you, but my life has been so much better since I've started discovering these things about myself. And the people around me, it's helped people around me too. And I'm just so grateful to have had this experience, this revelation, this self-discovery. Mm-hmm. That has brought me out of the darkness, the human conditioning that can just, it's really a barrier.
So what, you also worked with disabled babies, did you? Or you worked with infant massage?
Yes. For 2 years, I worked as a volunteer at the neonatal intensive care unit at Natividad Hospital in Salinas.
Oh, okay.
And I worked with really tiny, sometimes really tiny babies, and tried to engage them on a level of connection that they could handle, because sensory stimulation for babies that are generally that are born prematurely is overwhelming. And it was so satisfying and so wonderful. It was my segue before Julian came into my life. And I was working with all kinds of babies. Sometimes the stress in intensive care was amazing, but I think I got help staying calm while things going on behind me were crazy and they're trying to save the life of a child or a baby just died, or, you know, everybody just really falls apart. They don't fall apart, they just stop. The whole intensive care unit just stops when that happens. They really, really are, at least at this place, sensitive and wanting to keep life going. It wasn't a harsh clinical setting. It was a wonderful setting.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't hurt to cry and so on and go through the trauma of it all. I think it's very interesting that if you're doing that kind of work with infants, if they are doing it, probably can heal a terrific amount of what could be very terrible damage for a person, eh?
Yes. Well, you know, one of the things I did at that time, there was a woman, Tiffany Fields, at the University of Florida, the medical center in Florida, and she was working with babies even more young than I was, with one-pound babies. She had developed a study program for students to do touch therapy, and she was measuring. There were measurable effects. And I had this occur several times when I was working with a baby that was having trouble breathing, and they were not getting oxygen into their blood. And what's so wonderful is you're sitting there, and they're hooked up to monitors, and I start doing this, having this interaction with the baby, and the monitor is just going boop, 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 going up, 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 100%, 100%, within minutes sometimes. They're breathing fine on their own. And it was really measurable, and Tiffany's done lots of studies. I went out there, and I trailed her. I walked around with her and worked with some of the babies for a week and learned a lot from her, and then came back and offered my services as a volunteer because nobody does this kind of thing in intensive care. And they said, sure, they were all for it. So I did that for 2 years, and then Julian came into my life, and he needed a lot of my care, so I couldn't do both.
Yeah, but by then you're really primed to bring influences, because what keeps occurring to me is the influence that you bring with your belief, right, and your heart, and all of that, and then your touch, all of that can really stimulate the life of a frail baby, right, or a baby who might even be, in quotes, crippled, that can be healed, you know. How on earth do they work on a one-pound baby? They probably can't even hold one, can you?
Well, sometimes, and even with me, I think the smallest one I worked with at Natividad at the time, they didn't have a trauma unit. So at the time, the smallest was about 2 pounds. And I would just reach in to the incubator and touch and hold that way. One of the things that little tiny babies seem to really like is when they're lying on their back, you reach under their legs and sort of just cradle their bottom and then cradle their head very gently and hold them kind of, I don't know how you'd call it. You just hold them like that, and very often that's all it took for them to be breathing better.
Wow.
Or to calm down.
That's stimulating the ganglion. Well, you know what's interesting is I heard a story recently about a woman who had been in a terribly, terribly scary drama where somebody marauded her house and had a bomb and all that and even blew it up. And anyway, she was recovering later, but she would go into shock. And the person who told us about it said just exactly what you did with this baby. You hold this adult with your hand on, probably not on the bottom end, without, because it might scare some kind of sexual fear or whatever. But you hold the like a baby and just do holding. And if you can, you rock them from side to side. And that it will take care of so much PTSD or so much huge trauma. And so it's similar to what you're saying, isn't it?
Yes. And after I did that, I did include Julian. What happened is I got this wonderful job working at a woman's recovery center with mothers and babies, and so I could take Julian with me to these massage groups. And he was the ideal baby. He would never fuss when I would massage him with the mothers and show them how to do it with their babies while we were doing it. He was just amazing. He'd smile and gurgle and lay his hand out. And, you know, some of the other babies weren't quite as easy. Their mothers were stressed out, too, and they were feeling the stress, and it could be very challenging sometimes. Mm-hmm. But I did that for about a year with Julian, too, and then after that, I couldn't continue keeping a job and taking care of him. He required more and more and more help, intervention.
Mm-hmm. That's a big job. Well, good for you that you did that kind of thing. That sounds so trite, Robin, and I don't feel trite at all about it. I'm just thanking heavens that you do that kind of thing, and so do other people, because the education it gives to the child that you can live beyond some of these limitations in a huge way, it's just amazing. And let's talk about Muji. How about him? How did he, you know, you brought him through some real blocks and some deep despair. And tell people how you saw him waking up. He didn't have a lot of massage.
No, he didn't have a lot of support either. But he did have Minty, and a couple of the other clan members, like the twins, who really were drawn to him and appreciated him, and they didn't really see him as something wrong with him. They just they liked being with him and doing stuff with him. And I guess the question you're asking me is how did he come through his difficulties when he wasn't given a good basis?
Yeah.
Well, I think basically I tried to have his mother give him something of a basis for questioning what's going on. In fact, she was questioning what was going on and before they got, I don't want to say what happened. I don't want to give a spoiler.
Don't give away the whole story. Interesting pieces that people will appreciate, I'm sure.
Yeah, but she was trying to give. She was trying to going through a discovery herself of what was beyond the medical model and what people were saying his outcome would be. So she was starting him to question, and then later on, nature was speaking a lot to him. I don't know if you recall, but for instance, the horse that he rode. Cooperated with him and got down for him. And it's like, there are no limitations here. Hop on me or let's go. He rode horses. He worked in, he rucked the hay or mucked the hay, and he worked in the garden, and he got so engaged with nature that he forgot sometimes his limitations.
Mm-hmm.
He forgot what he couldn't do.
Because he was very powerful in those roles, was he not?
Yes, mm-hmm. he got empowered. Yes, good observation.
And it's interesting because you and I and many, many of our listeners have had serendipitous experiences with someone who shows up or an experience that suddenly happens that appears to be a miracle. He has enough of those to make it really credible, doesn't he?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of, and he did forget some of his early miracles and occurrences that he was a part of. First of all, he didn't understand his part in them when he was younger, but later on, when he started seeing things happen around him, that empowered him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was starting to get a feel for, oh, when I do this, this helps people.
Mm-hmm.
What is this? And trying to discover, what is this that's going on with me? And discovering his spiritual essence, his spiritual power. And as he slowly experiments with it, he becomes empowered by that too.
I think it's just such a wonderful story. I'm just really excited that you wrote it. And it's so interesting to think of it being like a fable or a fairy tale or something, but it's your tale and my tale and many people's in a lot of ways, isn't it?
Thank you so much. Yeah.
So if you like stories, everyone, about people who discover their power and their ability to heal and their ability to step out of what's called a disability and help a lot of people, it's a very exciting journey. So check in to www.madmysticaljourney.com and talk to Robin Gregory about ordering this book or heard about the rest of her life and how she came to these wonderful visions and fantasies and so on. This is Veronica Entwistle saying thank you so much for listening, and let me know what you think. VeronicaEntwistle.com. You hit the Ask Veronica button and tell me what you like to hear on Paradigm Shifters.